Hello and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. At first, Winnipeg-born Ari Posner set out to build a career as a songwriter. After discovering that perhaps his abilities as a lyricist did not match his musical gifts, he moved into the fast-paced world of ads, which gave him the training to work in myriad styles and deliver on a deadline. Now he is one of Canada's most respected and prolific screen composers. In collaboration with Amin Bhatia, he has scored award-winning hit shows such as Anne with an E, Flashpoint, and X Company, and with Ian Lefebvre, shows including Carter, Johnny Test, and Super Noobs. In this episode, we talk about his stirring solo work on Northern Rescue, and get philosophical about the long-term effects that the pandemic has had on his working life, the upsides of having a studio in a commercial space, working remotely, and ask, is the spotting session dead? We also dig into his methods for capturing and repurposing ideas, using the mirror test, the amount of emotional information a scene can have and how music fits into that, dealing with client feedback, when collaboration goes wrong, plus an incredible insight about screen music from Canadian acting icon Combe Fiore. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. Now please enjoy my conversation with the one and only Ari Posner. Ari, welcome to the show.
Hey, Adrian. Thanks for having me.
I wouldn't say I want to begin at the end because there is no end for us right now. There's only the current moment. But when we were chatting the other day, I thought it'd be kind of an interesting place to start, which is sort of where you are at and what you're sort of thinking about sort of post-pandemic, some of the ideas that we were discussing last time, because I thought that was kind of an interesting jumping off point.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel in some ways post-pandemic, but in some ways not.
Right.
It still seems to linger, I guess.
I thought we solved disease. Didn't we solve it?
Yeah. especially in this country, you know, like we have a very conservative view about that, I think, if you look at the world. But that's fine. I don't know. I think what I was saying to you the other day was it's been challenging. It's been challenging to just hunker down and be at home almost 100% of the time. You know, I have a space downtown that I love to work at, but it just wasn't really necessary to be there. And they weren't even really fully open to everyone coming in. Most of the staff were working from home, so. So yeah, I think it's taken its toll on me for sure, and I'm trying to navigate now how to get back to that schedule of, you know, dividing my time up, going back to the studio downtown more.
Something that struck me as interesting in terms of how you work. I mean, so many composers. I've started at home in a tiny little shoebox room, and I've stayed at home. I've never actually had a studio space or an external space. And you're, I think, one of the few people that still has a place that they go to, a place of work. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, there's a number of different aspects to that. We tend to look at our profession as being really solitary, but I think you were sort of mentioning that they're kind of this. There's a social component to that whole thing, and an integration that sort of seems to be helpful.
Yeah, and it's hard to like. I think I took it for granted really for a long time, and then I've started to remember now during COVID why I appreciate that interaction, you know, and it's still a lonely job, right? Like we all know that how much time we sit in front of the computer and in our keyboards and our instruments, and you can't really be socializing with people when you're doing that. But just the ability to be in a space with other creative people, to walk down the hall and talk to someone and say, hey, come in, what do you think of this? Like, you know, just getting another viewpoint on things. And just seeing different walls and different faces. It was, you know, that is like, I don't know, there's something really valuable about that I kind of didn't realize I was missing until I started to go back down there and just dabble in just being in the office again, you know? So
Are you one of these people that still invites directors and producers over to your space to sort of do spotting sessions and to do reviews, or is it largely done remotely at this point?
That's a good question. I feel like nobody wants to do that anymore. Honestly, I really do. I even spotting sessions seem to be a kind of a thing of the past in some ways. It's like, here's the show, here's the temp score. Not that you need to copy the temp score necessarily, but it kind of tells you where most of the music's going to go, right? And certainly if you have some other ideas about where things should go or where things should could connect together, please, like, you know, tell me and let's talk about it. But to spend 4 hours or whatever it takes sitting there spotting, it just seems to be like a thing of the past, which is really bizarre.
So you're not even doing it remotely at this point. You're saying that for the most part, you're not even spotting at all.
Sometimes if they want to do it, like I always invite a spotting session for sure, but there are plenty of, you know, movie of the week type things that I've done where it's like, yeah, you know what to do. Just go, right? It's terrible.
When I interned with Donald Kwan back in 2007, I think, yes, 2007, I met Ron Korb, who's known to many. He's a flute player and a multi-instrumentalist recording artist. And, you know, he would come by Donald's place a lot of times for sessions and stuff like that. And I would really observe how much of that first portion of the session, usually almost an hour of, you know, paid time, would be spent just chatting and catching up and talking about the industry, what's going on. And, you know, when I sort of hung out with Ron and Donald, that would be a big part of what they would talk about, is this sort of the idea of the hang and how much, you know, there was this focus put on the enjoyment of the actual process. Like, we're not just making a thing. Like, we're not showing up at a factory and creating a widget that gets sent out for distribution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's getting lost? Like, I feel like my career has been primarily by distance. I'm sort of just like, this is what I'm used to. I don't have a whole lot of experience with the in-person thing. I like it when it happens. But I mean, also I find like the younger generation is so focused on just the work. Like the people that are coming up like maybe 10 years behind me, it just feels like it's all work and no play.
Mm. I do miss the hang for sure. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think we touched on the other day was just about some of my experience in advertising, where I have had a lot of time on the floor with musicians, you know, right. not necessarily big, huge ensembles, but just lots of musicians coming in and out. And that was always so fun. And it just seems like more of a rare thing these days. When, you know, when there's a session happening, it's like, oh, we got players in, cool, you know, like it's just kind of a thing of the past in a lot of ways, which is terrible. And so the same thing with working with directors and showrunners, you know, like when Amin and I worked on Anne with an E, for example, we would spot each show, even if it was in person or remotely, you know, like this was pre-COVID, whatever, but the showrunner wasn't always in the city. So sometimes we'd just have a conference call and we'd watch it together on, you know, both 1, 2, 3, start the picture. And then we'd watch a section and we talk about it. And that stuff is invaluable. It really is, like, in terms of the collaboration, you know?
Yeah.
I guess the things that, the shows that I'm talking about are just, it's like a volume business where they're just making so many of these micro budget movies and they don't have the time to sit and spot. They right. trust that they hire you. They trust that you're going to do your thing. And it's funny. I've done some of them where I barely even get a single note back. It's like, okay, that's great. Next. You
know? That's interesting. So you, it's not necessarily a product of, I mean, I'm not to say that you aren't excellent at what you do, but you're saying that it's actually just a product of how quickly they want to move. Like if they had more time, more money, more resources, they'd be like, let's dig into this a bit more and let's get some notes. But if they're like, nope, this is working, it's great, let's move on.
Yeah.
That's more common to have happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is more common. And again, I'm speaking about these sort of, you know, low budget MOWs. I don't know why we're talking about that, but that is kind of what's come to mind. But
sure.
But I think that they kind of also get, at least most of the producers kind of get that there's not a lot of time, there's not a lot of money. This person knows what they're doing. I'm not going to micromanage anything here. I'm going to just make sure that it's working. Like the broad strokes are working. There's obviously they're experienced enough to handle it. And so I don't know. It's sort of like an agreement that you come to at the beginning of doing those jobs, right? But it just reminds me, like, one of the films I did last year was one of these MOWs. I was having a conversation with one of the producers, and she was saying, well, this movie is going to be shown on, I can't remember what broadcaster had. It was like some channel in Europe or whatever. Right. It's like, we only sell 4 romantic comedies to this channel a year. So this is like, you know, it's kind of like, the stakes are a bit higher on this film because they, you know, we only sell four of these to them a year. We make about 80 a year.
Right.
80. Like, like, how do you even have time to talk to me? I don't even know, like, how you do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. The MOW, especially the romantic stuff, is that's a volume-based business for sure. I mean, and there's something that I appreciate about that. You know, people that know what they're making, they're not going to, you know, cause you to blow up your marriage because, you know, you're making some casserole or something, you know,
right.
Because it's comfort food. It's not, we're not trying to change the world with these things. And people who know that and know which side the bread is buttered on and sort of what the main event is, I think that's a healthy thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of the main event, like I sort of want to phrase this question a certain way, which might seem really doom and gloom, but I don't mean it that way. It's more to sort of get to the heart of what is where your heart is in this, like, what is the most important or the most joyful part of what you do? And the question is sort of like, if you know, knowing what you know now, would you start again? Like, would you get into this business given the new environment, the new landscape that is existing where you're not working with musicians as much, or it's in a remote situation, you're not having that kind of collaboration in the same way that you did before, and things work the way they would work, would you start again? And what is the main thing for you? Like, what's the thing you get up in the morning to do? Like, what's the main thing?
Yeah, I do... would I start again is a whole other question. I don't know if I got to think about that, but you know, what still inspires me and makes me get up in the morning and makes me feel good about what I'm doing is just, you know, getting in that zone, like where you just sit in the room with the picture and you just work on a scene there's a point where you get it right and it just feels like so satisfying, you know, where you're really helping the story and you're really amplifying the emotions, or maybe it's the comedy or, you know, whatever it is. Like, I love that. I feel like it's an unmasterable language and I don't really ever get tired of it. Mm. I do get tired of maybe, you know, sometimes if I'm working on one show for a really long time, like a series. Lately, I've been doing some stuff for PBS, kids shows, and it, you know, it's a conveyor belt. Like, you just, there's 40 episodes, and you just, one comes in, and you do it, and then the next one. So that can get tiring, and maybe not quite as, it doesn't light me up maybe sometimes in the same way, you know, but then I go back to just doing even a romantic comedy movie, whatever, that's for the Hallmark Channel. And it's like, oh yeah, this is why I do this. I love this. And I can make a day just pass by like that, without even looking at the clock or thinking about it. It's incredible. That's a great, for me, that's a great place to be. And I always wanted to, I think from a very young age, it was always important to me to try to find a job that I was not going to be bored at. Like, I didn't want to sit at a desk or be a lawyer or be, I don't know, I was never going to be a doctor because we're terrible in the sciences in my family, but anything. I wanted to be engaged. I wanted to find a job that I was going to be engaged with, and this is what it totally engages me, you know. It still does.
How do you keep the surprise of it or the mystery alive? Is that something you have to search for? Do you have a Do you have a sort of methodology or habits that you go back to when you feel like maybe you're tapping the same well too many times or things have gotten stale? What do you do to sort of break out and sort of, yeah, I guess surprise yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I certainly tap the same well more than once sometimes, you know. Sometimes I feel like I might come up with an idea that I think is reasonably clever or worthy of something, and mm-hmm. and nobody ever hears it or notices it or whatever, or it just goes, you know, on the shelf because the right. show never went anywhere. So I'll use it again. I'll try to, like, you know, recreate it in sure. a different way. It's like, yeah. But I don't, you know what, the method that I have lately, which it's always evolving, but one of the things that I like to do when I'm not nose to the grindstone, like deadline busy, is I just open up a template and I just start to look for sounds, and I just make tracks of sounds grouped together in different ways, stuff that I haven't maybe used before, or maybe I've used it but I'm not too familiar with the sound or whatever. And as I do that, I also start creating sketches, right? Mm, so mm-hmm. so I'll just like, oh, this is a cool sound. What does it inspire? And I'll just record a little 8-bar thing in Logic, you know, so that it at least I when I go back to that sequence or that template, I see a little bit of MIDI information there on that track that's sitting there in like, oh, maybe there's right. 300 tracks or whatever there, yeah. you know, and I'm like, oh, what was this idea? And it's like, oh yeah, and there's that sound. That was a cool sound. And so I just make these templates that have tons of little sketches in them. And then I'll go back to it. Like maybe I'm starting a new project and I'll go back to that and I'll just sort of mine this thing full of little ideas for just, you know, it's like, because I'll completely forget about them too. There's, right. You know,
yeah.
And I sometimes do that even just when starting a project too. I'll make a template that's specific to the movie or whatever it is, and I start to find sounds and I gather them together. And as I'm doing that, I start sketching and I just record, stop, go down here, record. Sometimes I change the tempo in the sequence because I need it to be a faster or slower thing or whatever. But there are all these little seeds of ideas that become really valuable as I start writing the project.
It's almost like the musical version of leaving 20 bucks in your pocket in the summer. So when you come back to the summer next day, like your summer jacket, and you pull it out of the closet and you're like, oh, 20 bucks, nice.
I wish I did that more often.
Well, you can start now. Yeah. That's really interesting, is leaving the ideas as little seeds inside a template. I never thought of that. Because, I mean, I have sort of like an idea folder and you sort of output an MP3 or something. But then I forget to go back to it.
Yeah.
And I also find that, like, for me at least, I've never been able to take an idea that was written externally of a project and put it in and have it feel like it was
part of it.
It always feels like a separate thing, like I'm trying to put something in. But that might be my own personal thing.
Well, I mean, look, the best songwriters and composers all sort of rip each other off and also themselves off, you know. I mean, I think John Williams has done it millions of times, and you have, I don't know, we all live in our own boxes and you have certain ideas or a certain amount of ideas, right?
So 100%.
You have to bank them and use them, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if that didn't exist, then you would never have a sound or a voice because you'd always be changing it. It would be
right.
completely indistinguishable from the thing you did, or it would be distinguishable every time from everything else you ever did.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like this process a lot. And just to talk a little bit more about it, like when I'm starting a project, I like to have this template that has the whole movie sitting there,
yeah,
or maybe it's an episode of a show or whatever, and I'll call that, like, you know, master template for this movie or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you can look at it from 30,000 feet, sort of thing, right? Like you scrunch Logic up so everything's super small, and you can just see the whole movie in one screen and all your little seeds of ideas, and so sometimes I'll just, you know, maybe as part of the spotting process for myself, I'll get to a scene and I'll be like, wonder if this would sound good. And I'll just make a little sketch there, right, in that spot. And I'll have a bunch of sketches throughout the film like that. And then I'll come back to it. Like once I've like sort of made the spotting notes, numbered everything, have my shopping list, so to speak, then I'll come back to those, to that main template, and I'll start to zoom in, right? And so I'm like, okay, let's go to this scene. And I'll take everything else out of the sequence except for that little sketch, and I'll get rid of the full sound from the picture because it's a huge file. I'll just get rid of that, and then I'll just make a new sequence and just create a little sequence with just that scene and that sound, and start working on that. And I keep going back to the master template and like, okay, let's work on this scene. I've got an idea for that. You know, it's kind of, I don't know. It's been an evolving method, and I find that it's working well. So
that's great. I love that. It's actually very similar to how I work in terms of like just looking at the project file and having that 30,000 foot view, which is actually something I learned from going to do a fine art degree post-secondary. The first thing they did, because they knew where we came from. We all came from like hunched over little sketchbooks drawing like this close to our face, and they made us attach our paintbrushes to the end of a yardstick. And then we had to paint, do a figure study based on that. And it was like awful. Like everything, I was just like, this is terrible. Like I have no control. There's no fidelity. Everything just looks like garbage. But they're like, now you know what it is to look like, to have to stand back. And you know,
that's
it just
so cool.
It was an interesting,
that's really cool.
Just, you know, more painterly strokes and like getting away from this, like one very specific way of holding the pencil and being so like, you know, right in the face up to the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of something I read that I think Leonardo da Vinci used to do, was he would draw stuff and then he would hold it up in a mirror to look at it.
Yes.
And he said you would see flaws that you didn't see from looking at it the normal way, right? And that made me sometimes like, sort of just like, you know, I'm working on a cue or something and I think it's finished, and then I at the end I'll sit in my room the opposite direction. I'll just listen from with my ears, you know, with the back of my head to the speakers, right? Like just to get a different perspective. And I've seen I saw one director do this on a film that I worked on too, where we were in the mixed playback and he just started to wander around the room and just like get down close to the floor and like just like he was just listening from different places. I just thought that's so awesome, you know?
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I noticed that effect in my home. We have a giant mirror in our dining room. We have an open plan sort of main floor. And you know, there's this kind of idea of hedonic adaptation where you get used to a certain thing and that no longer really registers. You know, it's the reason why the first cup of coffee you ever drank in your life is going to just hype you up and make you feel like you're on fire. And then, you know, when you've had 30 years of coffee drinking, it just sort of gets you to normal.
right.
And sometimes we can get used to, you know, in order to practice gratitude, we have to see things from a new perspective. And I noticed that when I looked at my house through that mirror and it was flipped, I suddenly saw it through different eyes, as if I was a new person or somebody else coming into this home that I'd never seen before, because everything looked alien. And I had this enormously different and much greater appreciation of the space and how it was set up. And I just thought, oh, this is a really cool, this is a great house. And it gave me that appreciation. I was thinking as you were talking, like, okay, what's the mirror image for music then? Like, how do we do that? And that's an interesting idea where you turn away and you're just sort of like blocking out the visual aspect of it so that you're no longer being informed. Donald Quam once said to me, be careful about writing to picture with the picture because the picture will make your music sound better than it is. And I thought that was an interesting
POV. Yeah.
For me, I always find like inviting someone into the studio and just listen to the piece of music. You get two bars in, you're like, you know what? Forget it. You can go. I mean, like just that alone. You're just like, no, I know it's all wrong. It's all screwy.
But that's not, I mean, that's not a totally fair test. Like for sure, when you listen to the music with someone else there and you hear it like with them, with their ears kind of like, it definitely puts things under a microscope and you hear it a different way. But, you know, I will say that oftentimes film music and TV music, it's like, it's not meant to be listened to on its own. Like there's you know, millions of cues that you would never put on,
right?
Because they're just, they're an accompaniment to the dialogue, right? Like it's like that it's a song, and those are the lyrics, and mm-hmm. I'm providing the bed track. Everything is completely dependent on that. And so sometimes, you know, you do these cues that they never really go anywhere. They're just simple pads, shifting, holding, you know. You wouldn't want to listen to that for on its own very long, I don't think.
Yeah. No, I'm talking more even two picture, just to have somebody in the room, like a body to test, like, does this emotionally feel right? There's sometimes a question about whether that's right or not. Mm. And I don't know, my experience is if I have a question, it's not right.
Right.
if I'm wondering, and it just takes that person to walk in the room for a second to sort of confirm that suspicion.
Yeah, you're right. I've had that experience too. It's like the client will just zone right in onto the like the one little thing that you are, you know, not sure about.
So. Yeah. Or absolutely love the thing you thought was just a castaway kind of like nothing idea that you were sure was going to get lambasted for being too lazy or whatever. Right. It's always, those become, oh man, we got to submit this for an award or something. You're like, please don't, not that one.
yeah, totally. Just trying to circle back to what you had asked about in terms of would I do this again? If I could start again, I don't know. Like, I think if I were going to do it again, I probably would have moved. Or I probably would move. Like, I'd probably get out of Canada and go to the big show down there, you know?
Right, yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure I would love it in LA, but I feel like even the mediocre or small to medium opportunities down there are just more plentiful. And if you're going to climb a ladder in this business, that's the place to do it. At a certain point, I had thoughts about doing it, but then I settled here with my family. We've got so much extended family here. It just became like a no-brainer. I'm not going to LA anymore. Mm-hmm. Am I unhappy about that? No, but if I was going to advise someone young starting out, you know, do you want to really do well in this business? I think you want to leave Canada. You know,
that's a really interesting point of view. I mean, I've thought about this a lot myself, and I don't know if I would necessarily advise that myself. I would say depending on what kind of work you want to do and the life you want to live, what's important to you. The people that I've seen become successful. And I mean, this is the thing. First of all, I would say it's a young person's game. You definitely have to have an enormous amount of energy and, be a very good people person and to be willing to accept that, you know, the likelihood of you actually breaking through in that very deep, very, deep pond, right? Yes, there are more opportunities, but boy, is there a deep talent pool there.
Sure.
With an incredibly gated community of you know, the way to the top is so nebulous. But then once you're there, once you're super successful, I mean, there's what you end up with, like the ultimate prize. Let's say you win it big. Is that the life you really want? And I think it's a very different thing than what I see a lot of, you know, people that have made successes outside of LA. They have lives that are more balanced. I think it's not all about career and pursuit and gaining of external, extrinsic kind of rewards.
Yeah, well, you make a very good point. We were talking about that the other day too. Like, I guess I'm speaking more of a very from a mercenary perspective. Yeah. Like, if you really want to, if you really want to make it, and you know, I actually had the same conversation, interestingly, with a comedian that I know who's a very successful Canadian comedian named Dave Hempstead. Mm-hmm. You'll hear him on The Debaters, and he's a headliner kind of type guy. And, you know, I reached out to him because a friend of mine has a kid who's interested in comedy. And okay. So they were just looking for people that he could talk to. Like, what kind of advice would you give a 17-year-old kid who wants to make it in comedy? And when I talked to Dave, he said, the first thing I would say is get out. That's it. Like, this is, you know, you can, no, but it's true. I really resonated with me because I thought it just brought brought home like things that I've certainly thought about for music as well. And, you know, it's, we've heard it a million times. It's like the real success, the real Canadian successes in music and show business, they always go elsewhere, and then they're recognized, and then Canada recognizes them, right? It's hard to do it. It's really hard to do it here.
Yeah.
So, but I'm all for balance, like you say. So at a long time ago, I made that choice. And I really like, I told you that I've done a fair bit of work in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that provided some balance for me. Like, it was a kind of a 9-to-5 gig, you know, and people operated that way. You show up, you do the work, the weekend, people didn't really work that much, like on the weekends, like occasionally, you know, you'd have to do a demo on the weekend or whatever, but it, for the most part, it was like a really balanced life. And I started doing advertising work in maybe 2001 or 2002. And it was a huge gift to be able to just have a playground to write and, you know, make music 30 seconds long or 60 seconds long, and then go home, and then, you know, have my own life.
So. Right. And it must've been a great, sort of just, you know, cutting your teeth and getting that blade really sharp, to be able to sort of grind through different genres and having to just produce every day. You have to like, just get up and make something and mm-hmm. deliver. You're shipping all the time as they say, right? This idea.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like that. I felt like, you get to work at all these different genres, right? Like, today you're doing an aria for an opera, right?
Right.
And then tomorrow you're doing a beer commercial and it's going to be like indie rock or here's a jazz thing or whatever. Like, you find how to get there fast, right? Because you don't have that much time. It's like, what's the essence of this sound? And you start to create that. So it's great. I really did cut my teeth like that. The trouble with it is that you get really, really good at flexing your, you know, I can take this to an A level. You get good at flexing that muscle, but you never get to flex the muscle of taking it to an A++, right? Like, you just never seem to have the time for that, you know? It's making an album or something, you know?
That's a very subjective thing. I always wonder, like, what's the difference between an A and an A+ that can be measured in some sort of objective way, you know? Like, what is that extra step? Like, what would you do differently? I sometimes wonder that at the end of a project. Like, I feel the old saying, if you never stop mixing, you never finish a mix, you just stop.
You just stop, yeah.
Same thing with film scores. I mean, eventually you just have to deliver and you go, well, that was as good. I feel like if I have the sense that was as good as I can do right now, then I'm happy.
Mm.
I'm never going to actually be in love with the music and think it was so great, because it's always going to fall short in some way. But if at least I feel like, well, given the time, I did as much as I possibly could. That sort of.
I think that's. I think we all feel that way. Like, even the greatest composers are like that. I don't think there's any difference. You know, I bet you money that Beethoven or Mozart or Brahms or whoever, they would they'd hear their piece, you know, a couple years later or whatever, and they'd say, you know what, I want to change that part. This could be different, right?
Yeah.
And they used to do that. Like, those guys were, you know, you think about these masterpieces as if they're written in stone, but but they're not. Those guys would alter things on the floor. They'd hear the orchestra and they'd go, no, this is wrong. Let's change this, right? So I think we're always going back and trying to perfect stuff. It's, as I said, I think it's an unmasterable language, you know?
Yeah, thank goodness for that. So let's go back a bit and help me fill in some of the blanks here, because I know you're born in Winnipeg, right? That's sort of where you spent your early years. And then you ended up studying at York University. Between that, you know, it's almost like you had the internet scrubbed. It's very hard to find more information about you. So tell me a little bit about, like, how did you, because there was an interesting moment earlier on when you said, you know, you kind of found this thing that you wanted to do that was sort of, you know, that's the right combination of of your proclivity, skill set, things that you're naturally drawn to and good at. How did you get to that point?
When I graduated from York, I sort of had my mind set on becoming a songwriter. That was what I was really most interested in. Mm. And I spent a lot of time and money creating demos. This was, you know, long before the time when you could just do it in your basement or in your house or whatever. Like, yeah. I would go to studios, I'd hire singers, players, like, you know, I was sending songs out to music publishers. That was like my dream job. I really wanted to do that. Turns out I wasn't so good at it. I think okay at it, but I wasn't really, I think, a particularly good lyric writer back then. And that was sort of a missing piece for trying to write a good song, you know?
Sure.
But at a certain point, and by the way, just to backtrack, like what I did when I first got out of school was a lot of playing for dance classes. That was like my main job.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So like I could, you know, piano is my instrument. I'm okay at improvising, I guess. And I got connected to the dance department at York while I was there to sub in for some classes. And then that just led to full-time work as an accompanist. So I did that for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years after I left York. And then also did some teaching, private teaching, and some playing in a jobbing band as well, bar mitzvahs and weddings and that kind of stuff. But that was like, that was what I call the time in the trenches, you know, like, yeah. I really was just trying to be a songwriter, and those things were supporting my songwriting habit. It wasn't until I met a composer just through a family relationship. I was introduced to a guy who was doing scoring, and that was the first time that I got introduced to that world. And I worked as just doing odd jobs and, you know, hanging around the studio and running errands, and it just allowed me to see the process. I sat in on sessions, I watched how things got mixed, and it eventually led to some opportunities to co-write, because there were some songs that needed to be written for this show, the series that he was working on, and so we did some co-writing on a whole bunch of songs. And that was the first time where it's like, whoa, I just got paid for writing a song. You know, that was like, there was a deadline and we did it and we recorded it and then I got a check. So that's kind of cool. And that's where it just kind of blossomed from there. Like then I started to get into the whole underscore thing, which wasn't my focus at first, but it quickly became my focus because I could see that I could do it and that there were jobs to be had and that I could actually write music, deliver it, get paid for it, as opposed to this nebulous kind of thing as, oh, I hope someone's going to hear this song and cover it. And then, right. You know, so that kind of thing.
Was your family musical and were they supportive of your career choice and where you were sort of moving towards?
My family's very musical. My parents, not by profession at all. Like my dad's a lawyer and my mom was an ESL teacher. They're both retired now, but my mom played the piano. My dad loved to sing. They totally nurtured music in our house. You know, my friends used to call us the Von Trapp family. they like, in, you know, totally kind of cutting funny way. Oh, it's the Von Trapp family, you know. Like, but there was always talent shows going on around our house. I have tons of video of me accompanying my sister singing, my brother singing, playing, you know, piano pieces for company that came over. So that's where it came from for sure. Mm-hmm. And they had no issue with me going into this world. Like they really encouraged it. Mm-hmm. they uh my dad likes to say we're not strong in the sciences in our family. So that, so anything that you can do that's not sciences, you should go and do it.
That's interesting. I've never heard someone describe a parent talking about the you know, what the family does well, like as an entire unit, as opposed to individuals. That's like, collectively, we're good at these things and not good at these things. And this is probably a wiser choice.
Well, he's looking historically at our family, I guess, yeah. You know, and just yeah. saying like, here's where we've netted out for the most part. I mean, there's the odd doctor here and there,
sure.
You know, cousins of his or whatever. But, you know, my uncle, my dad's brother is a pretty successful writer. He wrote for Maclean's and The Globe and Toronto Life, and has mm-hmm. been writing books on, he's writing a series on Leonard Cohen actually right now. So
oh, wow.
he's done a few of his own projects like that.
It's always interesting too, like people's paths towards these things. Oftentimes, you know, people can see from their parents having done a certain thing, they see the path forward, right? Like, this is possible. I know how it's done. I've seen it done. Musical families tend to produce musical children who go on to musical careers
mm-hmm.
and so on. And then there's the people that just sort of come out of nowhere and manage to figure out all these things. And in our case, you know, for what we do as a profession, it's not just the musical part. Then it's the storytelling. Then it's being a business owner and an entrepreneur right. and having to market yourself and la, 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 la. There's all these other skills that you have to develop somehow. And if you're never shown the ropes, you know, you kind of have to figure it all out on your own.
Yeah. I've never been particularly strong at that stuff either. Like the storytelling and the business side and of marketing and administration, all that stuff. It's really, it never came naturally to me for sure.
Mm.
I feel like I picked up a lot of it, from being around the people at Pirate, like downtown at the office there, where it's just, it's an advertising shop and it's business. And I just, you know, through osmosis, like picked up a lot of tips and ways to how you do things in that regard. But at the beginning, I was really awkward with that stuff for sure.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you're not good at storytelling, because that seems to be when I watch and listen to your work, that would be one of the first things that I would say. In terms of what you're really great at is the ability to sort of understand a story and really know exactly what to give it at any moment.
Hmm. Well, that's really, I sure appreciate that, those words. That's nice to hear. I guess, I you know, there's storytelling like that is behind the scenes, right? You're there sitting in a room by yourself working on it over and over again. Storytelling for real is like holding a room's attention, right? And actually yeah. being on the spot and being able to like do that. Like I've worked with Terry O'Reilly and guys like Rick Sherman from Pirate, where these guys just know how to hold a room and just babysit the clients and talk to them and make it yeah. all like, and they can tell a story and it's great, you know, I'm just, that's for me, that doesn't come naturally. So,
well, that's a good distinction to make, I think. And it's, you certainly see people that have made great success being able to be great communicators, storytellers, mm-hmm. hold a room, you know, persuade people, make people feel comfortable. Those are all incredibly, advantageous things to have if you are so inclined.
This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show.
I know this is sort of a buzzword in the business world, certainly now. Storytelling. Everything is storytelling. And I'm like, yeah, well, it's true, but also you're bastardizing it a little bit. But and certainly my friends who work in publishing and books, they kind of grit their teeth every time they start to pull out the
right.
S word.
The S word.
But I mean, I think it's, you know, there's an aspect of, you have to understand storytelling. You have to understand the arcs of a narrative. You have to understand why characters do things. There's an aspect of psychology to it. And when what we're doing, I feel like is almost an alchemical process. We're going, okay, there's this raw material. Now, how do I make that into something else that the audience will understand in a certain way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of hours, yeah. like of just doing it over and over again. I found and failing. Yeah. I do like I've you know, sometimes people send me stuff to listen to and check out, and they just want to get advice on stuff, and they'll send me a scene that they did, and it's like, this is great music. The music sounds great. The melody's awesome. The chords, everything, but it's not telling the story in the way that it's supposed to. You know, like it really, it's one of the challenges of doing this is the math, right? It's like how do you make the music and have it turn on a dime and have it shift with the story, and when is that exact moment that it should shift? It's subjective too, right? But I just find that now, I don't know, like I would be shocked if I could sit and be a fly in the room in my studio like 20 years ago and see what I was doing then. You know what I mean? Like sure. I find now I can watch a scene and I can really see the moments quite quickly, you know?
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of practice.
I think it's to me, what comes to mind too, is that it's an ego game, right? Like you're basically trying to become less attached to your music and less self-interested in what you're doing and attempt to abandon any attempts of being clever or wanting some sort of external reward for your efforts, because really you are trying to be of service. And I mean, I think that what you're describing, I've seen that too so many times where people write really nice music, but it's like you're really making it about you. Mm-hmm. You're not making it about the story. You're not making it about what the filmmaker's vision is or, mm-hmm. you know, what actually is necessary here. Sometimes what's necessary is not that exciting to write.
Yeah.
Or even to listen to, as you mentioned before, you know?
Yeah. And I think just to, you know, go back to the advertising thing, I think I learned that lesson from advertising pretty quickly as well, because you know, you write your very best moment in the track that you're so proud of, and if it happens to be stepping on the product shot or the dialogue or whatever, it's like, see you later, that's gone, right? And so you learn to have very little, in some cases maybe too little attachment but you have very little attachment to what you're outputting, you know. And I've had this conversation with Amin lots of times, like where sometimes, you know, we get feedback on a cue and he's trying to sort of maybe fight for it, make an argument for it, which I respect. But me in my advertising mind, I'm like, fuck, we'll just do it again. Like, you know, like, whatever, I'll just go back. It's no big deal, right? You know, so I have maybe too little attachment sometimes to pieces.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think the people that I've met, and it is a shocking, very uncomfortable experience to meet people who have truly disassociated themselves from any of the attachments. And by that, I mean to say they find no joy in it at all anymore. Hmm. In one case, a composer told me he doesn't even like music anymore. And I just thought, wow, like just this gray kind of ghost of a person. Like it wasn't a good thing. Like it wasn't like, oh, you've now reached nirvana as the Buddha sits beneath the tree and achieve this sort of like eternal bliss of not being attached to earthly things.
Right.
No, you're just a miserable person because you've been so ground down and just given up on the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's an interesting balance, right? Like how much do we subjugate ourselves to the needs of others or the will of others? When do you fight for things and when do you let it go?
Yeah. It's a very, and I feel like, Amin and I are different in that way. Like he tends to fight more for things and try to, I don't know, give the client like a perspective. It's like, here's why we did this, you know?
It
actually makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And whereas I'm like, I'm not going to sell them on this. There's no way I'm going to sell them on this. I'm just going to do it again, you know? So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting game as well. It's like, where do you sort of try to say, well, I understand that this doesn't work for you and we'll change it, but here's the reason why I did it, in order to sort of prop up some sort of like idea about you not just being completely out to lunch in terms of your approach.
Right. But you know, here's a question for you. It reminds me of the whole notion of sitting in the room with your client when you've written stuff. Yeah. Like it used to be that you would present stuff, right? Like you would sit in the room with your client and you'd play them the show or the screen or the section or whatever it is, you know, in commercials, there would be a presentation of the ad. Nowadays, that almost never happens. It's like upload, send it, Dropbox, whatever it is, you know. Do you think that's better? Like, do you think it's better in the sense that they get to sit without, like, they can just have their thoughts about it without, you know, being colored by having you in the room? You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know if I would say it's better or worse. I'd definitely say it's different. I would say the more important question that I would be concerned about is how does the feedback come to you after they've made the decision? I think it's nice to be able, like if I have to give someone critical feedback on something in the room, I might not feel ready. I might want to sit with it for a bit longer. Like there's times when I've said, look, don't give me an answer now. I know this is a little controversial what I've done. I want you to just like watch this a few more times.
Yeah.
And they say, you know what, Adrian, I hated it when I first watched it, but now that I've seen it a few more times, I've gotten used to the idea and I actually think this is a good direction. But then it's more important, like, how does that feedback happen? Some people are really good at writing very succinct, helpful emails, and some people can't do it worth anything. Like, to me, that feedback section, like, why are you saying no, is more important to me than how the material gets to you.
Right, right.
Yeah, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. No, it's like if you can sit and have a conversation maybe after the fact, or if it's an email, it's an email, but you know, probably better to have a conversation and let them have absorbed everything and then give you your thoughts. You know, it's interesting because I remember a long time ago one of my colleagues, he was a composer out in the East Coast, he said, oh god, I would never want to sit in the room with my client while they're watching the stuff. And I thought,
or compose in front of a client. I know some people are fine with that. And I'm like, what? This is like having somebody watch me go to the bathroom. Like, this is the worst thing I could possibly imagine. Like,
I do actually enjoy a little bit of that. I want them to watch me go to the bathroom, but I do enjoy sometimes sitting in the room with the client and just going, what do you think about this kind of thing? I think because I have enough keyboard skills to do it that I don't feel awkward or you know, like embarrassed about it. I can present ideas in a succinct way that can get the notion across, right? And sometimes it's great because sometimes they're like, ooh, I like that. And then they feel like they're engaged in the process, right? Yeah. So I don't mind doing that. And sometimes in again, back to advertising, it's saved many situations where the client's down the hall and they don't like something and they just come into my room and I'm just like, oh, well, we could add this, you know? And and they're like, oh, that's great. Let's do that, you know? Yeah. And then they're happy, right? So...
I mean, there are so many different ways to do this. And I think that's a good point, though. I mean, there are certain skills you need in order to be able to do things a certain way. Like if you want to present on the moment and come up with a new idea in the moment, your keyboard skills have to be, you know, fairly high in order to do that. What's in your brain into the...
Are you a guitarist first? Or I can't remember.
I'm a guitar player first, although I think I'm fairly... competent in a kind of hacky way, if that makes sense, on the keyboards. Like I certainly couldn't play a sonata, but I can get my ideas out fairly succinctly. And I just, you know, for me, it's not like Tom Third, who's on the first season of the podcast, he said this thing that I just love, which is my music is a byproduct of this process. It's the data exhaust. And I think, I mean, although that makes music seem less valuable, I don't think that was his point. I think the point is the process is the thing that you're really hired for, And if the process is correct, then the music will also be correct.
Hmm.
And for me, the process has much more to do with language than it has to do with music, which is a language too. But for me, that's a translation. So I say, okay, we're going to have a conversation. You tell me what you want. I'm going to interpret some things for you in words. We're going to hash out a bunch of language. You're going to send me some tracks, and I'm going to sort of cross-reference those with the words that you've given me. And then I'm going to do ultimately a big translation of all of that into music. And then I'm going to check that against your ideas and see if that translation is correct. And then I adjust.
Wow.
That way, for me, when I'm, because it all has to come back to language, when we're talking about what the music is, we go back to the words we used and the references we chose. And then we go, where are the words failing us? Or where have I not made the correct translation in terms of what the words are saying and what the music is saying? Hmm. And then they go, well, I wanted more, you know, I wanted to be damper. I need this dampness. Okay, this isn't damp enough. This is a terrible example.
But no, I get it. I totally get it.
And oftentimes if I'm stuck on what to write, I'll go back to words. I'll go back to like, well, effervescent, sizzling, tightness, coiling ever tighter around the character. Okay, coiling. What's music that sounds like it's coiling and getting tighter? What's an actual motif or like a device, a musical device that coils and tightens? And then I go, okay, I know what to write now because right. I use the words to get me there.
Right. Well, it's sort of, you're sort of making it kind of a scientific method in a way, right?
That's true.
Which is good. Like, it's like, let's eliminate all the possible places that this could go totally awry, right?
Yeah.
But there is something still that about music where you just, I don't know, it's like you could do all that and get all of that right, and then someone could hear and go, yeah, I just don't like it.
It happens all the time. Absolutely. Yeah, right. I just don't like it. I mean, there's nothing, you can't argue that. I just don't like it, or it doesn't vibe with me. I don't feel like this fits.
Yeah,
that's fair. And in terms of like client feedback, I like it to be just as direct and succinct as possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not cutting, but, and sometimes cutting works though. I don't know.
Cutting can work, yeah. Well, I mean, and I told you the other day too about that time where we're working on Flashpoint, and the Anne Marie, the producers, we just couldn't get the scene right, and we tried to do the scientific method. It's like, okay, what do you want to feel here? Give us some words. What mm-hmm. do you want to feel in the scene? She says, I don't want to feel anything. I want to feel nothing, right? She just wanted music because she didn't want the scene to be quiet. And so that was like a real revelation. It's like, oh, my music's actually making you feel things that are not relevant to the scene at all, and you don't want that. Okay, I just have to be like invisible.
Yeah.
And being invisible, I think there was an article that just came about this recently in one of the composer magazines, just about an invisible art. Like, you're just trying to not be noticed, but provide the support, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's hard. I think that's a really hard thing to do. It's sort of, you want the music to be noticed because you've spent your time learning how to write music, so...
This is a perfect segue into Northern Rescue. So when I asked you about some of the projects you wanted to talk about, I really appreciated you said, well, this year's some stuff I don't feel like got enough love, or, you know, we've had CSA wins for other things and with an EX company, Flashpoint, mm-hmm. all these things that you've been very successful with a lot of other collaborators and also on your own. And it's kind of neat to go into the stuff that, you know, maybe didn't get that same kind of love, but has this incredible value. With Northern Rescue, so I know you're very proud of that score, and it sort of gave you this opportunity to do something that was very much in the wheelhouse that you wanted to sort of sit inside. And when I watched the episodes, well, first of all, boy, does that show just throws you into the deep end of the emotional swimming pool right
off
away.
The bat. Yeah, right it's off like, the bat, yeah.
Fuck you, here's the most horrible thing that could happen.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to sit inside this for an entire 45 minutes or whatever uh-huh. it is. And it was the perfect introduction. I didn't have to wait to sort of go, okay, how's Ari going to handle this? Like, where am I going to get to like season or like episode 4 before I really understand how he's going to deal with this? And that is what I would, the primary thing about what I would say. And incidentally, it actually contradicts to a certain degree what you're saying. What you're doing is definitely not invisible. There are points at which it is more of an ambient sort of like cushion
texture,
or like some sort of like texture that just sort of the scene floats on top of it. And without it, it would seem like something was missing, or it would feel I don't know, just kind of dry or naked.
Yeah.
And then there's of course the big, you know, the big revelation or the thing, and I'm not giving anything away. If anyone hasn't seen Northern Rescue yet and doesn't want to be spoiled, spoiler alert's coming up, but this is already written about in the description of the episode itself. A family experiences the death of their mother to cancer, and it all happens very suddenly. And everything about it is sudden. You're just thrown into this experience with this family almost from the get-go. When that moment happens, when the loss, the real loss really happens, you turn the music. It shifts.
Hmm.
And it's absolutely beautiful. It's also just the right amount of everything. Like, you're not pushing it too far. You're not giving us not enough. You're not getting melodramatic. It feels like it sits inside everything. And reflects and also elevates what the characters are feeling without it feeling like we're being manipulated either. And it's to me, that's a magic act. I mean, you just nailed it.
Nice. Wow.
But I did notice. I'm like, first of all, that's a beautiful piano sound, and just the whole texture of the score is so gorgeous. But then just that, I'm just going, this is so like right there. Like, I do notice it. And those chords and what you've chosen to do there. And just that limit that you go right up to the edge, and then you're just pulling just back. I mean, I have to say, like, how did you do that? Like, was that a conscious effort? Is that just your experience and you know how to do these things? Was there a lot of thought and effort and trial and error that got you to that point? Like, what was the process to get there?
Well, I'm not sure exactly which scene you're talking about. Maybe it's the part where there's the funeral.
But it's just before too, when Billy Baldwin is sitting in his car and he starts to cry because he knows what's coming.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah. So, well, I guess I would give a lot of credit to the creator and the showrunner, Bradley Walsh, for kind of giving me like the freedom to really go for it on the piano in that show. Like, he really liked what, I don't know, just this, there was, he's described it as, I guess, a soulful sound that I could come up with. But the piano sound itself also, he said, like, this is a broken family. Like, this is horrible stuff is going on, right? Like, I don't want the piano to sound pristine. I want it to sound like a bit out of tune or a bit just like not well mic'd. And it's like, and it's got to be really reverby. And like, he had very specific, because he's a bit of a musician himself. So he had some very specific ideas about that, which was great. But so, you know, give me a show where I can make the piano the center of things and put pads around it and stuff. And I also hired Joel Schwartz to play guitar on the show, and he's incredible. Like, he's just brought so much to that show. And he even wrote a handful of cues too for that show, which was which was amazing. So it's just a great sandbox for me. I love that. If I could just keep writing shows like that, I'd be happy. You know, I'm trying to remember, like, the references they gave were things like Friday Night Lights, which has an amazing score, right? And there was another one. Oh, well, I guess there's a little bit of like This Is Us kind of vibe in there in some ways. Anyway, I do, as I said, I do credit Bradley with sort of letting me go to town on the piano in that show.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there's so many different ways. There's sort of like, if you sat down and you said, okay, sad thing on the piano, you know, A minor descending, you know, very like harmonic scale kind of stuff. You know, there's a kind of like approach to that that's, we've heard him many times before, and it instantly becomes melodramatic. And I was just really impressed that you, I mean, it feels like restraint. It feels like an enormous amount of restraint to me, which I think is really great. But Paul Inson, I don't know if you know Paul.
Yeah. I've met him. He's a composer and bass player.
Yeah.
I've met him lots of times. Yeah.
Really brilliant composer, very, and great orchestrator as well. Mm-hmm. He said something interesting to me when I interviewed him for, I can't remember what it was. I think it was a DGC event of some sort. And he was presenting The Nut Job, which is an animated feature. And
yes, I remember
he was talking about this idea of informational latitude, this idea that there exists a space that includes both sound and picture, and it has a headroom to it. There is only so much that can be injected into this space before you start to have kind of slopping over the edges, and it becomes this gooey mass that no one really, that becomes unapproachable. Or I guess that's when you get into things like melodrama or things just not feeling right. But he was talking really about visual information and how much there is versus a film narrative in an animation. It was really interesting, this sort of distinction that he was making. Have you ever had discussions with directors, producers, showrunners, creative people, or other composers about this idea of emotional latitude or emotional informational latitude within within a picture, and how far you can push things, and how to know how much is already there?
Right. Well, I've certainly had conversations with showrunners or creators who you can tell that they are not happy with the scene, and they want you to pull more out of it, right? It's okay. Let's inject more emotion here, or maybe it's adventure or whatever it is. It's just, there's just not enough of it happening on screen. They're thinking, I envisioned it this way, and it just wasn't captured visually, and they probably spent a ton of time in the editing room trying to make it right, and they're still not happy with it. So I'm sure you've been in that situation too, where you know that they need more, and they'll pick on your music a lot in those kinds of cases too, right? It's like, because it's just, I'm gonna beat this to death. I gotta get this scene right. So
it's the only thing that's left that can be actually changed.
Sometimes I just know it. I just know it's like they clearly were not happy with the performance or the or the lighting or whatever it is. But I mean, I do remember having this discussion with Anne-Marie on Flashpoint, where the guest star of the show was Colm Feore, and there was always like a big sort of monologue at the end of the show, some kind of talk down, some kind of, you know, really like dramatic but also emotional moment. And I used to score a lot of those scenes, like Amin and I, you know, we'd divide up the work, and he was clearly so much better at doing like some of the big action-y stuff and the chases and the tension. And I tended to like gravitate towards more like the softer stuff, right? Like that's, you know, but I remember her talking to us about that scene, saying like, you know, on the day when they were shooting the scene, they kept asking him if he could give it more emotion. Like it just was, he was just too flat. And he actually said, well, I'm not going to overplay this. You're going to get your emotion from the music. Mm. And that was like, first of all, the foresight of, any good actor probably does think that way, but I never thought about it like that. And it also sort of reminded me, oh yeah, he's not actually acting with music in the room. He's just doing, it's like a whole different way to give, how do they play it? Just enough, like just enough that it's right, you know? Crazy.
I mean, that is one of the most insightful and masterful observations that I think I've ever heard. I'm just completely blown away by that. Because not only would you have to think of yourself as part of a process, as opposed to only being invested in your egotistical sort of POV at that moment, saying, I'm an actor, I'm on stage, this is my moment, even if it isn't so self-serving. But then to be able to, like, you know, they say they make a movie three times, once in the script, once in shooting, and then once in post-production.
Right.
To be able to see through that process to it, I mean, has he has he been in a dub stage situation and seen it all come together, or has he been in the composer? Like, how did you know?
It's a good question.
How do you judge that? How do you almost melt it down to a science of percentages where you go, I'm going to give this much, music will take up this much, sound design and the rest will take up that much?
Yeah. Yeah, it's it's a thing that probably takes a lot of years of experience, right? To be able to think that way. And I had another experience with the director, which was kind of similar, where this was on a film that I did called Tulipani, which I scored with Jim McGraw. We worked together on it. And it was an Italian movie, which was the first time I ever did a foreign film.
Right.
But I remember there was this one scene where it was a beautifully shot scene with, like, you know, like a field full of tulips and the two main characters like coming together and hugging and just like having this romantic moment. And the music really needed to swell. Like, it really needed to have a big, you know, orchestral kind of push to it and swell to it. It had piano, but it also had all these strings. And so when it got to that point, I remember him making a comment. He said, "You go big, but don't go too big here, because no." But he said, yeah. I don't want to have to duck down your music,
yeah,
because it's gotten too loud in its parts or whatever. I want the whole cue to just stay present, and so just let me rot, like, go a bit bigger, but let me ride it up in the mix, you know? Like, he was thinking about that ahead of time, right? So
right.
I thought that was great.
That's interesting. It makes me think about the ideas of, I don't know how to put this, directionality. Like, there's depth, there's width, there's volume.
Mm.
There's all these things you can do to create the sense of largeness or scope. You don't have to go volume. You don't have to add voices. You can almost, and a swell can be so many different things. And that's certainly like, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in this position where people say, I need more. And then you write the biggest, loudest, you know, headroom maximizing thing you possibly can with the drums pounding and everything you've thrown at this mix. They can't go any bigger.
Right.
They go, I need more. I'm not feeling it.
Right, right.
And you just go, what am I missing? You know, right. What am I missing?
Oh, they probably don't like the scene in the first place. they didn't like the performance.
It could be that, but I mean, and sometimes it's not what they say they want is not what they mean. They just don't have the right words for it. You know.
Yeah.
Sometimes when they say I want it to be a faster tempo, they just mean double time. Like, I need more, like, just make me feel like this is moving along. I don't mean the tempo to be faster. You know, it's just, it's a tricky thing sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, just maybe it's just more moving parts within the tempo that just make it,
right.
You know.
Right, it could be so many different things. You've mentioned a lot of people as we've sort of gone on, Jim McGraw, Min Bhatia. I know you work with Ian Lefebvre and many others, of course, recently as well. How has it come about that you've had all these collaborators and you've worked with all these different people?
I didn't really do it by design. I mean, Amin was the first person that I started collaborating with because he gave me a shot, like, when I was, you know, up and coming, trying to find my way in this business. And, you know, we struck a relationship that just, you know, the right chemistry, I guess. And we fill in the gaps for each other, I guess, in terms of, you know, like what we can do. But I don't know, like, I think maybe also just from being around Pirate and doing advertising work, I that's where I met Ian Lefebvre. That's where I met Jim McGraw. Who was working? He had an office downstairs there. It's just like that thing of like just being out in the world, you know, and meeting other people and not just sitting at home in front of my computer. And I like it. I like the collaboration for two reasons. I think that sometimes there's synergy, you know, that just you would never imagine. And that's a big part of our job anyway. Like when you're collaborating with a filmmaker, you know, hopefully it's a collaboration that takes your music to a place that maybe you didn't actually think of at first, right? Like that mm-hmm. it's going to make it something fresh and new. I also just love not having all the pressure on me either. Like it's a very, I do. It's like it comes back to balance, right? What we were talking about before. I'm not the kind of person that's willing to just, you know, spend my whole time holed up in my studio and not do anything else. I love to play squash. I love to go for runs. I've got three kids. I need to take a vacation. Like I just love that I can say, hey, I'm out for a few days. You can cover? Cool. And then he'll say the same to me, right?
Yeah.
It's great. It's like, it's just a nice way to do it.
A lot has been said about how people divide the work as collaborators and how they sort of split up cues or maybe take different themes or different moments or different styles within the piece. I'm wondering about the practical side of like speaking to clients and having sort of a unified voice in which you're speaking and reacting to things. Have you found that it's sort of a new thing each time out? You have sort of to have an agreement with the person like, okay, I'm going to take the meeting and I'll say X, Y, Z, or we're going to do it together. Has there ever been friction in terms of there being a disagreement that sort of crops up unbeknownst to both of you and creates tension in the room? Like, how does that all work?
It definitely makes it more complicated when there's two people rather than one.
Right.
You know, for the most part, I've managed to juggle it, and it's never really been a big problem. But I will say that recently I did or tried to do a show with three people.
Okay.
And it did not go well. It was just too many voices, and every meeting took three times as long. And so I think that there's something to be said there for, like, if you're going to work as a team, great, but let's have one person be the point person, the liaison, you know, so that we're not, because everyone's got opinions and things to say, and not and a lot of the times it's often important and good, but it just eats up a lot of time. So I think for the client's sake, it's probably smarter to have just one person being the point person. Now, that said, I mean, Amin and I worked on Flashpoint and with an E and X Company all as two people, all every meeting together, and it all went fine. It was all great. Mm-hmm. So it's not impossible, but I think it can get tricky.
Right. Because you have to pick your partners well and know what that relationship is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just human nature that, like, you have a conversation about stuff and you want to say something, right? Like you want to put your thoughts in too, even though you've already covered everything that needs to be covered. It's like, I want to add to what Ari said or blah, blah, blah. Like it just is natural that people do that. Right.
Right.
And I've been working on a kids show lately that's been tricky. There's been a lot of people on every meeting, not composers, but a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you can feel it. Like you can just feel like this is taking way longer than it needs to, you know?
Right. Or the worst case scenario where some producer will say something contradictory to another, and then you have to sort of have that awkward conversation. Like, who's the real boss here?
Yeah. Who am I really? Yeah. Who am I listening to? That's right. Right. That can be tricky. Goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. That can be tricky. the other day when we were chatting, I asked you to sort of give a thought to a message that you wanted to get out there or something. If you wanted to say something about, you know, what's going on with your career in the industry or a word to other fellow composers, sort of give the floor over to you to something that you wanted to talk about.
Right. I think that you and I talked about this, like it's, you know, if you want to do this job, clearly you got to do it because you love it. It's not, it's not like about the end game so much, you know, it's about the process and about, I don't know, finding your voice, I guess, and just bringing something to the table that is really you, right? And hopefully the other stuff comes from that, right? I guess that you, if you do that and you're true to your, to yourself, and obviously if you have the talent, that people will notice it and that you'll be able to build a career like that. But I think that the best advice I can give, and I used to go and talk at York University to fourth year music classes, like just about like what now, you know, looking ahead, how I'm graduating, and this one teacher that I knew there had me come in a bunch of times to do this same lecture. And what I said at that time, and I still say it, is that at the beginning of your career, I don't think you really have a lot of control of where the opportunities are coming from. Mm-hmm. They kind of just come. And so you have to have your in a way your eyes like looking around at 360 degrees. And you might have your plan that's like, this is where I want to get, but an opportunity is going to come that's going to take you over here this way. I guess this is a podcast, so probably I shouldn't be using my hands for for directions, but you know what I mean? It's like you take a left turn because the opportunity's there, and very possibly it takes you on a whole different path, or maybe it takes you back to the original path that you had your eye on in the first place. But I just think it's like, I know I spent a lot of time early on in my career just sort of barking up the wrong trees and trying to like move ahead in ways that just were not smart. And it's like you have to really kind of have a plan, but be flexible about what you're going to, where you're going to take those turns and those opportunities come up.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And I think that becomes ever more important as you move through this career and you realize that you did end up taking those opportunities, and it may be this, the idea of where you thought you were going to go when you were 17, 25, 33, you know, 41, they're going to inevitably be different than what turns out, because you're not a god in control of your own destiny. You can't design these things. And I think that's really wise advice and good counsel to say, hold those things loosely. Like, yes, have ambitions, have a direction you want to go in, but don't, you know, don't forget to look left and right and say, oh, this is here at the doorstep now.
Yeah.
And it excites me. It interests me. It feels good. And let's do it. You know, it might not be the exact thing you had in your mind. But yeah, that can be the most valuable thing that can possibly happen to you.
You just never know. You never know. And I would, you know, sum it up in two words, which I try to instill in my kids. I don't know if I've successfully done it yet, but flexible thinking.
Yes.
It's like, how can you be flexible in the way that you approach this task, this person, this situation? Mm-hmm. And I do that with cue writing all the time. I'd like just to be able to not have one or two ways that I approach a cue. It's like, okay, well, don't know how I'm going to start this cue, but I know over here that I want to do this because this is like a moment that I just know what I want to do. So I'm going to just start there and then I'll work backwards and I'll see what, like, just to be able to approach a problem with flexible thinking, I think is invaluable. And I have one son who's very inflexible in his thinking. So I'm really trying to, you know, I've been trying to work on it with him. He's 18 and about to start university. So I'm hoping it'll change.
Any interesting finds in the world of music, art, TV, films recently?
The shows that I've really enjoyed lately were I just watched the last season of Better Call Saul, which I loved. Yeah. And I'm sure you probably saw White Lotus. That's already probably old now, but so it's not new. But that sure was a wonderful revelation in just a musical approach to a show. I don't know if you saw it or not, but it's...
I have the man himself on the first episode of this season.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, I did not know that. I gotta check that out.
I was thinking, like, how do I say this? Because this is, we're recording this like months before we actually even released the first episode, so the timeline is like jumbled in my head. But yeah, that was a very interesting conversation. Yeah, and a great, great show.
And just like, yes, it inspired some new ideas for me too. Mm. Like just the way he approached that show.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I couldn't get over also how loud the music was in it too. Yeah. It's just so loud. It was just
wow.
Like, yeah. Like they're at a buffet and like they're just talking about nothing and this tense music's just blaring and stuff, you know?
Well, that's, you know, when I think of Tapia DeVere, I think like that really bucks the whole conventional thinking in our industry that music shouldn't be noticed, because man, his music is noticed in everything he does.
Yeah.
And it is not a deterrent. It's not a detraction. It's definitely a very big benefit because he creates this whole new character.
Exactly.
Muscles its way beautifully into any scene, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's great.
But you need a certain kind of collaborator in order to go for that, right?
Yes.
Like there's plenty of people in this country who would never go for that. And I say this country because like we're the polite, you know, Canadians where everything's quiet and like it's just the music's down. And I think that what he did in that show is so cool, but it must have been the person that he was working with, or the creator, must have been like, yeah man, do it. Yeah. Let's go. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's worked with a lot of international collaborators, but he is Quebec-based Canadian and Chilean-born Canadian.
Chilean, yeah, that's right.
And he cut his teeth in Canada. Like, he came up here.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it's possible, I guess, it's really his whole attitude. This is the thing he said, is like, I put out this record in 2006 to show that I was an artist with a very specific vision.
Hmm.
And that I wanted to work with people who had that same kind of idea. And I think, you know, that's, if you know, I really found that inspiring. Like, you can sort of put a big marker, a stake in the ground, and that can work too.
I have nothing but respect for that.
Yeah.
Of course, he must be in LA now though, right?
No, he's still in Quebec.
He is?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's totally surprising.
Well, a very big, very interesting farmhouse. Yeah. Hmm. No, I'm sure he makes trips down there, but no, he's maintained his foundation in Canada.
Inspiring.
Yeah. Very inspiring. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ari, what's next for you, and where can people find you online and follow what you're doing?
Well, my website still exists. ARIMusic.com. As you said, I'm not big on social media. I don't do a lot of posting on Facebook or Twitter or those things, just not my nature. But my next project is actually a film that I'm doing with a director I've worked with before called Sean. His name's Sean Garrity, and the film is called The End of Sex. And it's sort of a companion piece to a film that he did many years ago called My Awkward Sexual Adventure, which I scored.
Yeah.
So this film has some of the same cast, and it's basically looking at a couple who, you know, they've got two kids that are, I don't know, maybe 10 and 12, and they send them off to camp for a week, and they try to rekindle their sex life. And as you can guess, chaos ensues, right?
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds like a film for the ages, for sure.
Well, yeah, I've mentioned it to a few people my age, and they're like, oh yeah, that resonates. Yeah.
Oh, too funny. Well, I'll look forward to that. Yeah, Garrity's great. And my Awkward Sexual Adventure was fantastic. So I'll look forward to that as well.
Nice.
All right. This was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for taking the time. And lots of great insights here. I'm going to be pouring back over this episode and taking some notes of my own for sure.
Awesome. Well, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. And as you know, I always love reading your posts and emails and in the Screen Composers forum there. I never miss an Adrian email. I always learn something from them. I do.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you very much. Well, have a great rest of the day, and we'll catch up soon.
Sounds good.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.